We the voices behind the faith of the Hawaiian nation, the Hawaiian race, rise for justice, the day has come for all our people to stand as one. E ala e, e ala e. We the voices behind the face, the Hawaiian nation, Hawaiian race, rise for justice, the day has come for all our people to stand as one. E ala e, a, e ala e.
Aloha, everyone. This is KP here from KP Radio Hawaii. We're speaking in the afternoon of October 10th on the 1010. And we have a special guest today. In fact, you're my first guest on the program.
Oh, good.
And so this
well,
is a, yes, this is Ali'i Mana'onui, Lani A. Sinkin, and Lani, I wondered if first you could introduce yourself. I think a lot of people would be interested in how, what the title of, what your title means, and how you receive that title, Ali'i Mana'onui.
Well, the Ali'i were the high caste in Hawaii in pre-contact times. Actually, if you go deeper into the history of Hawaii, there were no caste systems until the Tahitians brought their caste system to the islands. And in that system that was brought by the Tahitians, the Ali'i were the ruling group, and they were responsible for oversight of everything within the islands. And then there were the commoners, the Maka'ainana, who were the people that actually worked the land and all
right.
of that.
Right.
And in the Ali'i system, the king or the high chief, there was no king then, but the high chief would be the one responsible for the overall well-being of all the people and for the relationship between the civilization and the gods. So the high chief had the responsibility of maintaining clear connections with the spiritual basis of the civilization.
Okay.
So this particular title, Ali'i Mana'onui, Mana'o means heartfelt thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So if you and I are exchanging views, I'm sharing my Mana'o with you.
Yes.
So this was a position that was created by the last queen of the kingdom, Queen Liliuokalani.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a position that she created, which was designed to specifically provide her with someone that would always tell her the truth without any fear of retribution. So she, as the ruler, could rely on this person to say if she was out of line, if she'd made a mistake, or if she'd done something wrong. That person could say to the ruler, "You goofed." And the ruler would say, "Thank you very much." That was the nature of the position. And really a very creative and necessary position when someone has a whole lot of power is having someone that can say to them, "You made a mistake."
Yeah.
And their promise to withhold any retribution or any punishment for speaking the truth was to give the freedom to that position to say what needed to be said. The queen was overthrown before she could actually fill that position. But the king today, Edmund Kaligi Silva, knew about the position. And when he and I started working together 8 or 9 years ago, he said he would like to appoint me to that position for him. So my sacred obligation to him is to be a trusted advisor and a friend and to speak bluntly to him if I think he's done something wrong or he's out of line or whatever. And he's supposed to accept that as, you know, he doesn't have to necessarily agree with me,
mm-hmm.
but he has to accept that that's what I have seen and I've shared with him. And then it's up to him as to what he does with it. And there's no blowback to me for having done that service to him. That's my job.
Yes. Well, you know, I mentioned before that I feel that that's really to have someone respect you and honor your judgment, your mana'o, in this, you know, in that degree is really, I would expect you would feel quite honored by that appointment of that title.
Oh, clearly.
And why don't we first go into a brief history of you, of Lanny, maybe you can give us a brief of your life, where you grew up, and your education. I know that, you've participated in various, arenas, on planet Earth. So, could you give us a little bit of your background?
Certainly, and I've been on the planet for 68 years, so it's too long a story to tell the whole story.
Oh, you're just started.
I grew up in I grew up in San Antonio, Texas, and grew up in a very Jewish heritage, strong commitment to the Jewish principle of tzaddik, which means justice. So. The obligation of a practicing Jew when I was being raised was to bring justice in this life. It's not about the afterlife. It's about doing the right thing in this life. And that also meant that if there was injustice being committed against others, an obligation to try and stop that injustice as well.
Mm-hmm.
I went to my first political rally when I was 10 years old. My father was very involved in politics, and my mother was too. They were both icons in the San Antonio community. My mother was here for 90 years. My father was here for 100 years. And when they left, the outpouring of respect and love for them was absolutely phenomenal. They had been of service to their community throughout their whole life. So that's the model that was set forth for me as I was growing up. And I was in the same footsteps in the sense of being politically active and fighting injustice. I was involved in organizing students for Kennedy Johnson when I was in high school. I coordinated an anti-war effort in Cambridge, Massachusetts in the 60s. I went on to do litigation. I became a lawyer. I spent 10 years in licensing hearings for nuclear power plants, trying to prevent that technology from spreading. I was a lawyer on a racketeering case against the private covert operation that was part of the Iran-Contra scandal. I filed suits on behalf of the whales against the U.S. Navy and their high-intensity sonar testing on the whales.
You mentioned one thing in your legal history, and that is you tried to get standing for cetaceans to bring suit without a human surrogate. Could you explain that a little bit?
What I was doing in that case was two things. This was a case in which the United States Navy had come to Hawaii to test low-frequency active sonar, very powerful sonar that happens to be in the same frequency range as whales calling to each other operate. And I filed suit to stop the testing on the whales. Ended up filing five different suits against the Navy during that period. And in one of those suits, I took on what was a rule of court that seemed to me to contradict a rule of law. So the law was the Endangered Species Act. And if you read that act, it's very clear that preventing extinction of any species was a very high priority in the act, and that everything should be done to prevent harm to species that were endangered.
Right.
When those cases came to court, the courts had developed a rule that said, well, even if the species is harmed, you still have to have a human harmed in order to bring suit. So there was a suit about crocodiles in Egypt being brought by people who studied them, and the court said, well, your connection to them is not strong enough for you to have standing to come into court, and we're not going to allow the crocodiles to be in court without the human surrogate. So the case was thrown out. I'd watched that case. And I'd also read a very powerful book that was called Should Trees Have Standing? And it was a book written by a law professor suggesting that natural systems should have standing to come into court without a human surrogate. So I brought suit It was basically the Cetacean Community versus George Bush. And I was arguing to the court that the cetaceans, as endangered species, should have the right to be in court without having to be represented by some human who was also harmed by the same activity. The judge in Honolulu tossed out the case and took it up on appeal to the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco. When the opening arguments began, I went after the Navy about not having prepared an environmental impact statement for the use of this high-frequency sonar during threat and warfare conditions, and the judges stopped me and said they really wanted to focus first on the question of standing. And in an interesting development, the two of the judges were there. One of them was appearing by television from Nevada, where he was sitting on a case in Nevada. So the first question from the judges was, actually it was from the judge in Nevada. He said, "Mr. Simkin, are your clients in court today?" And I said, "No, Your Honor, but then neither are you. So maybe one day we'll have the technology where we can communicate with the whales and understand what they're trying to tell us about what we're doing on the planet." And everybody in the court cracked up. Everybody enjoyed the argument. We had a wonderful argument. But the upshot of that case was that the judges ruled that it was up to Congress to give standing to animals. It wasn't something they could insert into the law. That, however, there was nothing in Article 3 of the United States Constitution that prohibited Congress from granting standing to animals. So they basically ruled Congress could go ahead and give standing to animals or to endangered species if they wanted to. There are other circuits in the United States where there have been cases in which animals have gotten standing. Loggerhead turtles in Florida got standing, and that case is still there. So that was that. That was what that was all about. It was a great joy for me to try and do that. To expand the protection for endangered species, to be representing the whales, and to try and change the law. It was all sort of a lawyer's dream for me.
Well, what period of time was that? I mean, we're talking about, you mentioned Bush. Is that Bush 1 or Bush 2?
That's Bush 2.
Bush 2.
So this is in the late 90s, early 80s.
Well, one of the things that I know, you know, there's a lot of people who'll be listening to this from Hawaii, and I know that one of the things that I remember, in fact, I think it's probably the first time I read your name in the paper, was the super ferry that a corporation was trying to bring over here, which, you know, many people really thought that was a great idea. I've ridden on ferries before in San Francisco and all this and all that. Can you just briefly tell us a little bit about what the problem or what the challenges were with that?
I'd be happy to. And sure. I should note that I got a call, I got a call 3 days ago from a television reporter in Hawaii saying that candidates running for office now, right now, are talking about bringing Super Ferry back. And did I have any thoughts about that? And I shared my thoughts about that.
Uh-huh.
But this was the first time around where the Super Ferry Corporation came to Hawaii, and Governor Linda Lingle and her director of the department responsible for oversight of the Super Ferry basically waived the environmental laws for Super Ferry and did not require an environmental impact statement. So there was a very strong legal challenge brought against Super Ferry on potential harm that could be caused by the operation of the ferry. And a number of harms were identified, and included in those were that this is a high-speed boat, catamaran, operating at very high speeds, moving through the grounds where the whales give birth. So there was a potential for a strike on the whales. That was one. We also have a terrible problem in Hawaii with invasive species. But different islands have different problems. So on one island, you may have a mongoose, on another island, you don't. On one island, you may have fountain grass, and on another island, you don't. One of the concerns was that this super ferry, because it would be carrying the automobiles of the people getting on in one island and getting off in the other, might well be a vector, a transmission corridor, for an invasive species to move from one island to another. So that was another major concern.
Right.
There were different things that came along. One judge ultimately ruled that there was irreparable environmental harm that the super ferry could cause. The case did go to the Supreme Court in Hawaii, And the Supreme Court in Hawaii said that the Governor Lingle and her administration had made a mistake, and that the Super Ferry did have to prepare an environmental impact statement. It was at that point that I actually got involved in litigation, because what happened was Governor Lingle said, well, I'm going to put the Super Ferry into operation. And she sent the Super Ferry out to go to Kauai. And when it got to Kauai, people on surfboards had built a barrier of surfboards across the opening of the harbor, and the ship could not get in. And the Coast Guard was accompanying the ship, and the Coast Guard was totally frustrated. They could not break the barrier. They behaved in a very poor fashion, uncovering their 50 caliber machine guns on their boat, as if they were going to shoot somebody to get the boat in. But the boat turned around and went back. Governor Lingle then mobilized federal, state, and local law enforcement, including the Coast Guard, got the Coast Guard to create a security zone in the Kauai Harbor, where if anybody went into that zone without permission, it would be 10 years in jail and a $50,000 fine. And the Super Ferry was then protected in its illegal operation by Governor Lingle's multi-agency task force law yes. enforcement group. And I sued particularly the Coast Guard and said that they were using a national security law to protect an illegal private operation, that the Super Ferry was operating illegally because of the Supreme Court ruling. And the upshot of that case was that the court at the Honolulu level said that the Coast Guard had followed their procedures as required by the Administrative Procedures Act in adopting the security zone, so it was okay. They did not address the issue of whether Super Ferry was operating illegally. I took that on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit panel started their opinion by saying that we alleged that the Super Ferry was operating illegally and the Coast Guard was protecting it and that was not right, and then wrote an opinion that never came back to the issue of whether Super Ferry was operating legally or not. So in both courts, our key issue was never addressed. But the cases were thrown out. But meanwhile, the Super Ferry had basically been stopped. The judge in Maui issued an injunction preventing them from coming into Maui. And they could not earn any returns. And they went bankrupt. Actually, they'd been losing money the whole time. Very expensive to operate. So they went bankrupt and they went out of business. Another theme of all of that was that this boat was actually a test run for a company that was trying to sell these boats to the military for landing, getting troops close to land. And that this was all basically a covert military operation of testing this high-speed boat for something that would lead to a multi-billion dollar contract with the United States Navy. That's what was really going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, and for those listeners who do not know, there's a small presence of military here on the islands. There has been for quite some time, but
there's a massive military occupation of the Kingdom of Hawaii by the United States government.
Yes, yes. Well, how about we do this? Let me ask you this. What I think people would be really interested in knowing, what brought you to Hawaii? What happened to you to where you realized that you had a connection to Hawaii?
This goes back to when I was in Washington, D.C., working at an interface law and public policy center called the Christic Institute. And that was where we were pursuing a racketeering case against the private covert operation that was part of the Iran-Contra scandal. Another case that I worked on there was the Florida Peace and Justice Coalition came to us and said that NASA was going to be launching a deep space probe to Jupiter, the Galileo mission, and that the onboard power supply for the Galileo mission was 50 pounds of plutonium. And the decay heat from the plutonium would keep the equipment warm as it traveled and be used to generate electricity in deep space to operate the Galileo mission once it arrived at Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
And the Florida Peace and Justice Coalition felt that the 50 pounds of plutonium on a space shuttle, we'd already lost one by this time, was an undue risk and they should not be subject to it, and they asked us to litigate the issue. So we filed suit to stop the launch of the Galileo mission, and went through rapid fire through various courts in the federal system before they were able to actually take off. Now, sometime during that case, I was approached by a whistleblower who said that there were computers that came through his company on the way to NASA, and he was required to test them. In those tests, they failed sometimes and passed sometimes. He wanted to flunk the whole bunch and send them back to production. His management overrode his decision and said, let them go on to NASA, and we will get a repair contract when they figure out that they're broken. And this is how the game is played, apparently.
Right.
And those were the computers on the shuttle with the 50 pounds of plutonium.
Oh.
Well, the way we dealt with this was that the Christic Institute was founded by a group of Jesuits and others who had been very involved in the Karen Silkwood case. This was a case about plutonium coming out of Kern McGee. And in that case, they got to know a private investigator who was one of the top private investigators in the country. He was a good friend of the director of security at NASA. So we sent word through our general counsel, Dan Sheehan, to the head of to this private investigator who sent it on to the head of security at NASA. And the next thing we knew, there was a stand down of the launch, and they were taking all the computers off of the space shuttle and replacing them with another brand. And I always felt like that whistleblower may well have prevented a disaster.
Yes.
And some years later, after I'd left the Christic Institute and moved out to Portland, Oregon, the whistleblower called me from Hawaii. And he said they were planning to build a space launch facility on the island of Hawaii. And there was a whole lot of opposition over there. It was mainly on the risk to the island, the conditions of where they were building it, all these kinds of objections locally based. But he also felt that people should be aware that this might well be a plan to move these plutonium launches off the mainland, where our litigation had made them very controversial. We got a ton of publicity when we challenged Galileo and people learned about these plutonium launches, that moving them off the mainland and over to Hawaii, to the island of Hawaii, where there were 125,000 people and nobody could hear them complaining, was maybe the ultimate plan. And would I please come to Hawaii and testify to the County Council of Hawaii? And at the time, I'd been in Portland for a couple of years, and I had not taken the bar, so I couldn't practice law, and I was basically penniless. And I said to him, you know, I haven't got two nickels to rub together, so I can't really come to Hawaii. So the next day, there was a message on my telephone from a woman with a foreign accent saying, your ticket's been bought, you're on the plane tomorrow, you'll come here for 2 days, and then we'll fly you back home. So I said, hey, you know, trip to Hawaii.
I love that.
Up. And so I got on the plane. I flew over. I got off the plane in Hilo, and my whole body started to vibrate. And I had never had that experience before, and I didn't know what it meant, but I intuitively knew it meant something really special. So I walked into the terminal, and there was the whistleblower. There was the woman from the Netherlands who had left the message, and her elderly companion that she had been with for many years. I spent 2.5 days there and flew back to Portland and packed up and moved. And I knew I had been called to be in the islands. I didn't know exactly why. Well, it unfolded over the years why I was called to be there, all the preparation time. I eventually married the woman that I had met in the airport. We opened a spiritual center in Hilo called the Lightworker Center.
Mm-hmm.
We operated that for 3 years, morning, noon, and night. We had teachers and healers from all over the world that came to that center to offer classes and workshops. I got trained in 100 different disciplines just because I was coordinating it there all the time. And it was all preparation for where we are now. I know that now, but I was being prepared to serve in this capacity to help restore the Kingdom of Hawaii.
Well, that's pretty amazing. I mean, I was, when I first saw that in the documents you wrote, and by the way, I will be posting this along with this interview, so people can read what you've a little more detail about your history and your connection to the islands. So it's very clear that you had. Did you ever get the sense that perhaps you've lived here before, or was that any part of your decision to come here?
Yeah. It was not necessarily part of my decision to come. That was a very quick decision.
Yeah.
But I did have very much the sense that I had come home when I got off the airplane. And I've heard this from so many people that have flown into Hawaii and just, you know, burst into tears when they got off the plane or whatever, feeling like they had come home. For me, as I went through all the workshops at the Lightworker Center and got doors opened, it became clear that I was in the islands at the time of Lemuria, when they weren't actually islands, they were part of a continent before the continent fell. And that I had been there many, many times over the ensuing years and had many different responsibilities at the different times I was there. And that now was the time for a light worker center, not just our little center in Hilo, but the islands themselves to be fully what they are, because the world needs them to be fully what they are. And it's up to us to restore what was and integrate the new that we've understood in order to be ready to deal with the entire world, which is going to be coming to our door.
Well, I think that's, I'm sure that many people listening to that can totally relate to that, because, in my own case and many other people, I've seen people come here, visit, and they would step on the lava and they just break down in tears. They knew they were here before. And so I really appreciate you sharing that with us. And the next step that I really wanted to explore was your connection to the king, Edmund K. Silva Jr., and the Kingdom of Hawaii. I know that there's a little background to that before you actually met the king. Could you describe how that came about?
Sure. One of the issues that I got involved with when I came to the islands was the whole issue of sovereignty. I read a number of books about what happened with Queen Liliuokalani and the overthrow of the kingdom government. Kaiulani and her history. I read a lot of books just to get a feel for what it was all about, because people were telling me that there had been a real injustice. And once I understood what had happened, it was clear to me that the kingdom was never legally taken by the United States, and it had every right to be restored, and that the various sovereignty movements were an attempt to bring justice to the situation. I got involved with one group, the Lawful Hawaiian Government, and I spent a lot of time going to meetings and was at the first convening of the legislature that they put together. They actually went around in the islands to the old districts that were part of the kingdom government and found people in those districts to run for the legislature and elected and formed a legislature. It was a very moving experience. I was there when the legislature convened with the representatives from all the islands. And I spent a lot of time working with that organization. There came a point where the delegation from our island, the island of Hawaii, was not satisfied with the way things were going. And they said they were going to pull out of the organization. And I had similar concerns, and I said, well, I think I'm going to leave as well. I kept my connections just to know what was going on. And one of the people in our delegation, the sort of chair of the delegation, was a man named Sam Kaluna.
Yes.
And one day I got a call from a friend of mine, Athena Peanut, and she said that Uncle Sam was up to something and I should give him a call. So I called Sam Kaluna and I said, you know, what's going on? He said, well, the delegation that pulled out of the other organization had formed their own government. And they had issued a proclamation, adopted a constitution, and selected a king. And this, the sovereignty movement in Hawaii over the last 100 years has been characterized by many different movements, each trying in its own way to get the ball over the goal line and each coming up short for whatever reason.
Yes.
So I said to Sam, well, you know, what can I do to help? And Sam Kaluna said, well, you can get the king out of jail. And I laughed and I said, well, where is he in jail? He said, he's in jail in Colorado. And I said, what is he in jail for? And he said, he's in jail for theft by deception. And I said, well, you know, Sam, I did one racketeering case, but other than that, all of my practice has been environmental law. So I don't even know what that means, theft by deception. But anyway, well, how long is he in jail for? And the king said, 24 years. And at that point, I stopped. I said, Sam, rapists and murderers don't get 24 years. He said, you're catching on. I said, oh, it's political. He said, absolutely. This guy, they want to die in jail because they know he can do it. He can restore the kingdom. I said, well, okay, that's pretty heavy. So I flew out to Colorado, and I sat down with Pliggy, talked to him about his case and what had gone on, and got a picture of a bizarre case. I mean, the whole legal situation was that a woman invested some money with him to start two businesses. He went and started those two businesses and was moving right along, and she apparently had some problem with the IRS and came to him and said that she wanted the money back. And it was all invested, and the businesses were growing, and, you know, things were going well, but he couldn't cash them out to give her money back. And she converted that basically speculative investment into some kind of criminal offense and got charges brought against him in Colorado, where she had met with him once or twice. And it was years later that we understood that she had been approached and dealt with by people that wanted him gone. And it was a political prosecution. It had nothing to do with the law. He was basically put in prison for his political beliefs. And he had been in prison when I met him. He'd been in prison for about 11, 12 years. Very self-contained, very strong person, a martial arts master. He's in the Martial Arts Hall of Fame. So he had put himself in a necessary mental state to go through the prison experience, and was a pleasure to talk to and understand what his situation was.
Well,
so
can I interrupt you for just a moment?
Sure.
Pardon me. You mentioned that he was put in for 24, you know, his sentence of 24 years, but do you know who was behind this long sentence? Was it a national corporation or something in a national level, or was it local Hawaiian?
No, it was Hawaiian political leadership in cooperation with United States forces.
I see.
He had been very active and visible as a spokesperson for restoring the kingdom. And I think they understood that he might do it. I should mention that while he was in prison, I was talking to him on the phone almost every day once we had met. And there were all these things going on where, first of all, people should know, Sam Coluna asked him to be king. And he said, Sam, you don't want a king that's stuck in jail. You need a king that can be out and among the people. And Sam Coluna said, no, I've studied your genealogy. I've interviewed a lot of families. You are the one. And he basically had to talk him into it. He thought it was kind of foolish to be picking him because he was stuck in prison. But Sam did talk him into it.
Yes.
So at that point, the king then began writing letters to foreign governments saying, we are a nation occupied. We need to be restored. Will you help us, basically? And he was getting answers from some of these foreign governments, interesting answers saying, you know, we'll look into it, see what we can do. And one day he got a visit from a delegation from supposedly a foreign country, and he met with them at the prison. They set up a meeting room for him, and he met with this officer of a foreign government, and the U.S. Marshal was there, and other people were there. They gave him a letter that promised diplomatic recognition and a vast amount of money to support the restoration of the kingdom.
Really?
At this point, he put that letter in an envelope and sent it to me before he basically kept all his documents in his box in his room. So I got that letter, and I looked at the letter, and something didn't seem right. And the first thing I did was look at the flag on the letter, and I went to the internet and Googled the flag, and sure enough, the colors were reversed. So then I Googled the man who had signed the letter, and I found him in the government of that foreign country, but not in the position of chief finance officer, which is what the letter said he was. But I did find him in earlier years in the government of that country.
Hmm.
So then I went and I Googled the address at the bottom of the letter. and it was the United States Embassy in the capital of that country. And so was the phone number. So this was fraudulent letter, forgery, and I will say this, it was beautifully written. It was a masterpiece of psychological manipulation because it clearly identified the struggles of the people in that country with the struggles of the people in Hawaii, showed a deep understanding of the history of Hawaii and the history of that country. So someone had gone to a lot of trouble to craft a really sophisticated, persuasive letter to make him think he was talking to a foreign government when in fact he was not. And had he called the phone number or written to the address on the letter, I'm quite sure it would have gone to some CIA agent in the capital of that country who would have responded saying, you know, thank you or whatever, and continued the dialogue as long as they could keep him convinced he was actually talking to foreign governments, then that he would keep doing that. And actually he was wasting his energy because it was all a covert operation being run against him in prison. But one of the implications of that operation for me was a validation of what Sam had told me. They must really think he can do it if they're spending these kind of resources to create false communications to him and make him think he's in talking to foreign governments and writing eloquent letters to him. If they're spending these kind of resources, they really must believe this guy could be the one.
Absolutely.
So they simply validated for me that he was exactly what Sam Coluna thought he was, the one who could do it.
Yes, yes.
Now, one final piece of the story is that he was scheduled for a parole hearing. So I asked a priest in the Temple of Lono. The Temple of Lono is an ancient Hawaiian religion that was suppressed when the missionaries came and went into hiding and it's come out of hiding. And I've been involved with them in all kinds of ways. But I asked a priest from the temple to go with me to the parole hearing where we were going to say to the parole officer that he had been selected to be king of the restored nation, that if he was paroled, his job would be to work on the political movement to restore the kingdom, that he would have the support of the Temple of Lono as spiritual advisors to him, and that he would have as his job being king. And, you know, and when you go for parole, you have to say where you're going to be employed and that kind of thing. So we had sat with the king before the hearing, and we went into the hearing. There was one other witness who was going to be a character witness. And we went in, sat down, and when the king came in, he sat down at the table, his back was to us. And the parole officer said, well, Mr. Silva, do you want to introduce your guest? And he turned around, and his face was a mess. I knew something was really wrong. And he had trouble remembering our names as to who we were, so I knew something was really wrong. So the parole officer said, well, if you're paroled, what will you do for a job? And he said, oh, my family has a fishing business. So then we knew something was really wrong. And it went downhill from there, and he was denied parole. So after the hearing, we met with him. We said, what happened? He said, we got to the door of the room to go in, and the parole officer turned to me, and he said, I don't want to hear a single word about the kingdom. So he was sandbagged going into the hearing and couldn't even talk about all the things we had set up to talk about because they did not want to let him argue that the kingdom had a right to be restored. Now, a year later or so, he was coming up for parole again. And it was going to be in March. In January of that year, I wrote a letter to the chairman of the parole board. I need to back up for just a second. One of the things I did in Hawaii was to co-found an animal sanctuary.
Yes.
Rainbow Friends Animal Sanctuary. It's still there.
Yes.
It took in like 100 dogs and 200 cats, and it was a wonderful, wonderful thing. I was on-site caretaker for 7 years. One day, in talking to the kahuna of the Temple of Lono, we talked about having a special blessing for the animal sanctuary to make it a sanctuary specifically for animals, a pu'uhonua for animals. And we had set up the ceremony to happen in mid-January. I wrote to the chairman of the parole board in Colorado and said, is there a chance that we could get Mr. Silva paroled early instead of waiting until March so he could come to the ceremony? He would have the support of the Temple of Lono in the ceremony. He would be able to live at the animal sanctuary and work at the animal sanctuary and have a job and support and all of that. And I got a letter back from the chairman of the parole board saying that there wasn't time to notify everybody or whatever. And so he'd just have to wait till March. If I wanted to write a parole plan for him, I should go ahead and do that. Hang on, we got to...
Sure.
If I wanted to write a parole plan for him, I should go ahead and do that. Well, there I began to have a very interesting experience. Every time I would sit down to write the parole plan, a clear message would be coming from Spirit saying, don't do it. And I had a lot of conflict. I was his attorney. And my responsibility to my client, if they want a parole plan, is to prepare one. But I trusted Spirit. Spirit said, don't do it. So I did nothing. And I didn't go out to the hearing because I assumed nothing was going to happen. So when he sat down with a different parole officer, the officer was looking through the file and found the letter that I had written to the chairman. And she said to him, would you be willing to go work and live at Rainbow Friends Animal Sanctuary? Well, he had actually not seen the letter because they intercepted it and didn't let him see it. That's an attorney-client letter, I should point out, that they were stealing.
Yes.
So anyway, he'd never seen it, but he was quick on his feet. He said, sure, I'd be happy to do that. And she said, well, I like this parole plan. I like this what it says in this letter. We'll make that your parole plan, and I'm going to grant you parole. And another officer had to come over and agree, and he came over and agreed. And suddenly, he was paroled. Well, the chairman of the parole board was so upset by this that he called a meeting of the entire parole board to overturn the decision of those two parole officers. But the people on that board are the people that go out to the prison and do the interviews and make the decision. They didn't like his coming over the back of these two that had already made the decision and trying to reverse it.
Right.
So he had no votes on the parole board. So he voted for it in order not to lose face. So suddenly I get a call from the king saying, guess what? I'm paroled. So I flew out to Colorado and met him and flew him back to Hawaii. And he was on parole for a few years, and now he's completed that, and he's a free man.
Now, just
but it was
so people,
one of the many times in all of this that Spirit was speaking clearly.
That is a beautiful story. And just so people know, roughly what time, what year was that?
This would be, he got out, I think it's 2005.
Okay. Okay, so it's about 9 years ago.
He's been out about 9 years.
Right,
yeah.
And his parole period has ended?
His parole period has ended, yes.
Yes.
And there was another, just typical of the way things work. Somebody in the state government of Hawaii was looking through files and saw his name and realized they hadn't heard anything for a while about his case from Colorado. And they checked in with Colorado, and Colorado said, oh, we terminated his parole 6 months ago. But nobody told him. So there's been all these kind of things that have been done in his life to block him from going forward.
Well, how long then did he stay with you at the Rainbow Sanctuary?
Oh, he was at the Rainbow Sanctuary just for a short time, and then moved on to stay with other folks.
Right.
I left the Rainbow. I ended up ending in divorce and left the Rainbow Sanctuary, but was there for many years prior to that, and went on to work with him on continuing the effort to restore the kingdom.
Yes. Well, that's a perfect, I'll tell you, that's such a beautiful story, and I didn't know a lot of those details, and we really appreciate you sharing that with us, and I feel that one thing I think I'd like to go into here is now is how, since that time, how have you been assisting Ali'i Nui Moe, Edmund K. Silva? How have you been assisting him to really bring along the possibility of kingdom restoration?
Well, in a number of ways, I think the most important of which is serving that function as chief advisor and chief counselor. As we worked through many different issues, he has made a point of trying to address the different situations that have developed in the islands while he's been rebuilding the kingdom. And that can be the issue of Monsanto and the GMOs. It can be the issue of OHA, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, trying to create a native Hawaiian reservation and destroy the kingdom by dividing Hawaiians from the rest of the kingdom subjects.
Right.
And all of those issues. He's been very eloquent on many of them. And he and I have a very close working relationship. So we send documents back and forth. And I think that the biggest single achievement I see is that he has persevered in his position. This has been a totally barefoot campaign with no financial support. He's lived hand to mouth now for all this time, 9 years. And he has persevered in the face of personal tragedies in his life, in face of political opposition, in the face of no money. He has stuck to his mission. And in doing so, he's filled that place of king for the restored nation. Nobody else, others have stepped forward over the years and said, oh, I'm the king or I'm the queen.
Right.
And they've all basically fallen on their face and discredited themselves. He stepped forward and said, okay, I will accept this request to be king. And he has lived up to what he's promised. So he's been steadfast. He's been clear in his analysis. He's been helping people to understand everything about why they're in the situation they're in, the real history of the kingdom. He's helped to spread the teachings and understandings of a number of scholars about what's really gone on in the history. And I think the culmination of that for me was when the Departments of Interior and Justice, the United States Departments of Interior and Justice, came to the islands in June to hold hearings on whether to reestablish the government relationship between the native Hawaiians and the United States government.
Right.
Just to address that issue for a second here.
Yes.
There never was a relationship between the native Hawaiians or people of Hawaiian ancestry and the United States government. There was a relationship between the Kingdom of Hawaii, which had people of Hawaiian ancestry and people of non-Hawaiian ancestry as citizens. That kingdom had a relationship with the United States government that was characterized by treaties and full diplomatic recognition and promises of peace. And the United States broke the treaties and violated the law and violated international law in overthrowing the kingdom government in an act of war and annexing the kingdom government and with using an illegal procedure of a joint resolution of Congress, not a treaty. So this whole thing of reestablishing the government-to-government relations between Native Hawaiians and the United States government is what we call shibai, just nonsense. So
is that a Hawaiian word? Or is that I've never heard that word before. Shibai?
Yeah, it's shibai, yeah. Some of your friends will know where it's
okay,
from.
Okay,
anyway, okay. What went on here then is that the Department of Interior and Justice came out, the representatives came out, to hold a hearing on this phony issue. And more than 1,000 people showed up. There were hearings throughout all the islands. More than 1,000 people showed up. 95% of those who showed up said to these representatives of the U.S. government, go home and give us our kingdom back. We're not interested in being reduced to some kind of tribe that's going to have relations with the United States government through the Department of Interior, like Native Americans have. And this hasn't worked out so well for them. We're not interested in being reduced to that relationship. We had relations through the Department of State because we were a nation and you are a nation. And that's the relationship we should have again. You passed the apology resolution. The United States passed a resolution in 1993, yes, called the apology resolution, in which they detailed the illegal activities of the United States government in overthrowing the government of the kingdom, admitted to the illegality of them, said that the Hawaiian people had never given up their sovereignty, and basically then did nothing, just apologized for having illegally seized their nation. So the history is not really in question. It's documented and admitted to by the United States Congress in a resolution signed by Brother Bill Clinton.
Right.
So everybody knows what the real situation is, that Hawaii is an occupied nation, much as Poland was when the Germans invaded, or any of the other nations that have been freed from foreign invasion have been before they were restored. So that's what people came to those hearings to tell the United States representatives. And they got an earful, believe me, a big earful. And I think it kind of rocked them back on their heels. They thought they were beginning a process that was going to lead to some kind of nation within a nation of getting a little bit of land and a little bit of money and a little bit of autonomy, and there would be the native Hawaiians separated from the kingdom, divide and conquer being the apt characterization of what they were trying to do, divide and conquer the kingdom, and the kingdom would never be restored. And that they were particularly anxious to do this now, precisely because the movement to restore the kingdom has gained much greater strength throughout the islands.
Mm. Well, one of the things that I know some people noted that even in Kona here, that several people got up and started reading from the king's letter to Oha.
Oh, good.
He's
been very clear with Oha that he does not consider the Office of Hawaiian Affairs a legitimate body to speak for the Hawaiian people or deal with the issue of nationhood, because they are an agency of the state of Hawaii. They're an agency created by the occupying power. They have no business meddling in the future of the kingdom. And what Oha is doing right now is giving millions of, they spent millions of dollars on this Nation Within a Nation campaign. They're now going to give millions of dollars to other organizations who are pursuing the same goal and pretending like Oha is now neutral party and not doing anything. They just gave $3.5 million to somebody else to do it. And they think nobody noticed.
I think that, one thing that you pointed out was that the king has been... Oh, let me ask you this. I'll ask it as a question. What would you... Because honestly, I kind of think I know the answer, but I... Why do you feel that Mr. Edmund K. Silva is the one to lead the kingdom? You did mention something about that, because there have been many other people who have come forward and said, okay, we're the lawful nation of Hawaii, or we're the this group, and all this and all that, which is great.
Right.
But could you just address that briefly?
Sure. And part of my answer would be to urge people to go to the website that we have set up. KingdomofHawaii.info, I-N-F-O,
yes.
KingdomofHawaii.info, and read the document titled Vision and Plan.
Yes.
He has posted a vision for what the new restored nation would be like, and an idealistic and visionary and practical plan for how to get there. No one else who's come forward to offer to be king or queen has ever offered anything like the detailed plan that he has offered. That's one reason. Second, in Hawaii, in ancient Hawaii, genealogy was very important. And he has a genealogy that goes back into the mists of time and is linked to all the most important lines. So I think they probably, if I were to guess, I would say there's probably 200 people out there who have a genealogy that could step forward and say, I by my genealogy, I should be king or queen. And none of them have come out. None of them are on the field. He's the only one on the field now who's doing that. So if there were others who think they are more worthy or better prepared, they certainly haven't said so. And the king has said, if somebody shows up and says that they're better than me and can do a better job and can demonstrate that to me, fine, I'll step aside. But as far as he can see now, he's the only one out there. So his plan is genealogy, the absence of any real contender, and the fact that he has such a deep spiritual connection into Hawaii and its history and its ancestry, that he is constantly blessed with spiritual insights and guidance. I'll just say as a footnote, the way the United States government treated him when he was in prison, with their covert operations against him, helped to convince me that this is the guy that can do it.
Yes.
And just watching how he has performed over the last 9 years has only solidified that.
Yes, yes. Well, let me ask you this, Lanny. I know a lot of people are going to be interested in, and we have talked about it, of course, on the blog, on the KP blog, and on the kingdomofhawaiiinfo.wordpress.com blog, that how can people, or what do you see as as a way that people can assist the kingdom, or ways that people could assist if they do believe in this?
As I said earlier in the interview, it's a shoestring budget. So we have no real staff. I can't say that someone volunteers that I can offer them a position to do something. One thing people can do is let us know they're out there.
Right.
So I'm encouraging people to send me an email saying that they are supportive of the kingdom. If they want to be part of the kingdom, to include their background or qualifications or what skills they have or what they would bring to it. And they can send me an email to Lanny, Lanny, .Sinkin, Sinkin, at kingdomofhawaii.info.
Okay.
Lanny.Sinkin at kingdomofhawaii.info. They can send me an email, even to just say they're supportive. I can see that sometime in the not-too-distant future, we're going to create something called something like Friends of the Kingdom.
Yes, I was going to ask you
about
that.
Friends of the Kingdom will be all over the world. They'll be all over the world, and we will be calling upon them to do things in their own community. It may be hosting an event, or it may be setting up a chain letter, it may be signing a petition, whatever. That we're going to be having Friends of the Kingdom all over the world who will be encouraging their governments to give recognition to the restored kingdom, who will be encouraging their political leadership to support the restoration effort.
Well, I think that's a wonderful, very constructive idea. And I'll also point out that people know on the Kingdom of Hawaii WordPress blog, you can also go to the Contact Us page. And we've had many, many people who have filled this out. And, of course, I send them all along to you and to Judge Naidu and to the King and Jennifer, the Chief Justice. And so we also want to be sure to thank all the people who have donated from their funds, because this is helping out during this time of working with shoestrings and that sort of thing.
Yes.
One last thing is, I noticed that you have at the very beginning of the answers to the questions that we'd asked, you said this beautiful statement: "The mana of all Hawaii is rising." Could you, as a final thought, could you just briefly talk about that? About your feelings about
mana
that?
Mana is the spiritual force that enlivens all reality. It's basically the divine energy source. And in ancient Hawaii, there were practices for actually creating and enhancing mana, and for transferring mana from a person to another person, or storing mana in a stone. There were all kinds of ways in which people related to mana. The mana of all Hawaii rising is talking about the fact that people are awakening to the truth of what happened to the kingdom, and to the truth that the only real way to correct what was done is to restore the kingdom, and the truth that the restored kingdom has the potential for being a light unto the whole world. So it's like the true spiritual nature of Hawaii, which, you know, when I talk about the Friends of Hawaii, I think Friends of Hawaii is going to have millions of people join eventually, because so many people have been in the islands. They know Hawaii. They love Hawaii. They felt the aloha when they were here, and that they are going to want to protect and enhance and serve that goal of sharing aloha with people all over the world by signing up and supporting the restoration of the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that is part of the mana rising.
Yes. Well, Lanny, we thank you so much for joining us today on the KP Radio Show, and I hope in the future we'll be perhaps having other conversations when things come up, new things that you want to share with the planet. And again, we're very grateful for you being here and for everything you've done for Hawaii. So.
And thank you for all the service you've given to the kingdom. I mean, you've brought us to a much broader audience than we were reaching before. And now thousands of people are reading the documents that have been generated. It's been a real pleasure watching that grow.
Well, we're all doing a part. There's a lot of people doing their parts. And so for this part of the show, we'll say aloha. And thank you again, Lanny, for being with us.
Aloha to you. And actually, I am going to make one final observation.
Sure.
The kahuna of the Temple of Lono taught me that the word aloha referred to the experience of being filled with the divine energy or witnessing someone else filled with divine energy. And it's not unlike namaste, but it's a little different.
Yes.
And that in ancient Hawaii, the word aloha was never spoken because a word could not capture the true energy. It was just sort of a marker. You knew you were witnessing aloha, but aloha is a lower vibration as a word than the actual experience.
Right.
So it was a sacred word that was never spoken. Over time, it has spread itself. It has penetrated far beyond Hawaii. And it's waiting now for people to wake up to the true meaning that's out there. They know the word aloha. They think it means hello or goodbye. But it has so much more profound meanings that people are going to be waking up to as the years go by.
Wow. Well, that's a beautiful way to end this interview. And again, we thank you so much, Lanny, and we'll be talking to you in the future.
And my pleasure. Thank you.
We'll leave you with divine light and not speak the word.
Okay. Thank you.
We the warriors born to live, what the land and she can give, defend our birthright to be free, give our children liberty. Ea la ea, ea la ea, ea la ea, ea la ea.